Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. What do you get when you mix a Master's of Fine Arts and a medical doctor? The answer is Dr. David Teplica. He's a Penn State alumnus who uses his unique combination of talents in the fine arts and in plastic surgery to bring about a better understanding of human anatomy. We'll talk with him about how photography has made him a better surgeon, and vice versa, about the need for gender-specific plastic surgery, and about what he's learned from his decades-long study of identical twins. Dr. David Teplica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Fun to be here.
I read that at age 5, you declared you were going to be a surgeon. My guess is that most 5-year-olds have no idea what a surgeon is.
I had a mom who was a nurse. I had an uncle who was a psychiatrist. And I don't know where it came from, but I just decided that's what I want. And I stuck with it. Never varied.
Now, you grew up in Bellefonte. You were born and raised in Bellefonte.
Well, I was born in Bellefonte, but my parents lived in State College because Dad was an architecture student here on campus. And then he graduated and entered a practice for a little while, and we moved to Vermont, but then back to Bellefonte and was raised in Bellefonte, I think from about the age of 7 on.
Your father was a restoration architect.
Yes.
And your mother is a nurse. So
yes.
Really, you are this perfect blending of their two professions in so many ways.
Very few people pick up on that. You've done your research. You've figured these things out. Restoring the body or reconfiguring the body to look natural and elegant and appropriate.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But before you picked up a scalpel, you picked up a camera. Your interest in photography started in college at Penn State.
It did, but it was even before that because Dad had us drawing and painting the body. Mom had us learning the anatomy. I remember doing these things age 3, 4, 5. I don't know when it was. And I'm still finding some of these little drawings and things in the basement in boxes even now.
Well, speaking of those drawings, I have never seen anything like the markings you put on a plastic surgery patient.
Mm-hmm.
It looks literally like the anatomy overlay from high school. Delineated.
I believe that if we're going to try to produce elegant and natural and normal-looking human beings in the world of surgery, then we should be figuring out what their own underlying anatomy is. And so those marks that you've seen translate what's under the surface onto the surface so that the plastic surgical reshaping can echo that individual's own underlying anatomy. And you get incredibly gender-appropriate and natural and age-appropriate looking results. It's really wonderful.
You seem to be one of the very few plastic surgeons out there who's even talking about gender-appropriate reproportioning.
Well, remember, please, I mean, we don't want to be mean to my colleagues, but the field developed because of a drive by mostly women wanting to make manipulations. Historically, it wasn't so many men who wanted to make manipulations. And so our field is based upon the idea of feminization. A woman who feels inadequate from a feminine point of view wants to be a normal woman. A woman who's got too much femininity may want to have things reduced a little bit and converted to a more natural-looking feminine configuration. And so along comes a guy who has concerns about things, and there really isn't a structure in place to allow for appropriate masculinization. That has not been part of our history. And so I'm trying to help develop the concepts. I'm trying to help delineate what should be masculine and what should be feminine and teach my colleagues.
The result of plastic surgeons not knowing what you're talking about is this feminization of men. And I should say that there has been a 60% jump in the number of men who are seeking plastic surgery from just a couple of years ago.
Well, 60% means from 9% to whatever. It's a tiny number of patients who are actually men at the moment. So although it's a large increase, from a numbers point of view, it's not all that many men. Right. And I think part of the issue is that the field is really geared for women. And if a guy shows up in a waiting room to have a plastic surgical consultation, it's designed to help women feel comfortable. And waiting in a waiting room is a little awkward if you're a guy feeling inadequate about having man boobs or something. You know, it's.
And in fact, that's what a lot of men are going in for plastic surgery, to have male breasts removed.
Exactly. But what ends up happening is that they are removed, and the federal code for that is mastectomy for gynecomastia. Cut it all out, because somehow it's a bad thing to have fullness on a male chest. But if you go ahead and cut it all out, you leave a guy with a flat chest looking prepubertal. So not necessarily feminized, but some weird, non-defined gender situation. And so what I would rather do is to carve that fullness to look masculine, leaving as much volume as possible, because a guy wants to have a big chest, he just doesn't want it to be pointy. And so I think there's a different approach. I think there's a way to not blunt masculine gender, but to enhance it.
A lot of what you have learned and that you bring to your practice of plastic surgery is from your decades-long interest in studying identical twins.
That's true. For many, many years, my colleagues thought I was a little crazy for putting all my time and energy studying the basic anatomy of twins. But it's been a very rich place to be. It's been fascinating. I've proved 10, 15 years ago that about half of twins are almost identical for shape, and the other half are exactly mirrored for shape. Skin lesions that are on one side of one twin are on the same side of the other twin or on the mirrored side of the other twin. Nothing in the environment can account for that kind of mirroring of shape or of skin lesions. And so what it says is that we are genetically encoded to be who we are anatomically. And it's a great relief because it means that you're not a bad person. It's not that you're doing your bicep curls the wrong way. It's not that you're eating the wrong stuff.
You're genetically predetermined to have bigger hips or smaller arms.
You are, exactly. And the only cure for that would be to choose new parents. And that's something that a lot of people just don't get. And it's a little difficult.
Does it help you when you're working with a patient? Because you sit down and you talk with them about what their wishes and desires are. Would it help you, and do you ever say, I'd like to see what your parents look like?
I think it'd be great. And I probably maybe a third of the time I ask people to bring in family photographs to help inform the situation, or to bring in their own photographs at the various decades of life so I can see what's happening with loss of volume of the face, for example, or increased volume of other areas of the body. So if people have photographs, it's a way to predict the future or to get some kind of a little bit of an inkling about what might happen genetically. For example, if a man is starting to go through the change of life, which we don't think about a lot, right?
We think only women do that.
Right. But there's something called andropause, which is not very well understood. I don't believe it's not understood because it doesn't happen. I believe it's not understood because we don't stop menstruating. But the male body undergoes a very dramatic feminization in the fifth or sixth decades with development of breasts and all sorts of things. And so, but there are no real bad health consequences of that, and so nobody's going to fund it. It's not going to get big federal dollars thrown at it to figure out why man's body is changing shape. But when these things happen, they tend to happen in families the same way. And so if a gentleman is coming in expressing concerns about his body, it's a great thing to find out what happened to the uncles and what happened to dad and what happened to the siblings, because that can inform the decisions that are made for that one particular person.
Let's talk a little bit about beauty, because we all seem to feel that we recognize it when we see it. But as far back as Da Vinci, he felt that the most beautiful people were symmetrical.
Well, I don't know, and we're actually working a little bit on this right now. I've identified that there are some single individuals who are very, very symmetrical and actually mirror their own moles. Hair whorls that are the same on both sides, chest hair that flourishes and goes exactly with the same pattern on both sides of the chest. There's a subset of individuals, mostly men, who mirror themselves anatomically. It's interesting that they tend to be very robust individuals, successful football players, Hollywood stars. So there may be something to this idea of anatomic doubling or mirroring that allows us to say that is a fit individual or that's a beautiful individual. Women who are symmetrical are more rare in my analysis of anatomy, but when it happens, it's almost always a very successful model or a very successful Olympic athlete. I just operated on a woman who has mirroring of her moles, and she's been twice to the Olympics. And so there is something to that, but I haven't figured it out yet.
You say that some people don't really like what you're learning from your twin studies.
Some people are challenged.
In what way?
We are a country of entrepreneurship. We want to believe that we can better the world and we can control our own destinies and we can get to the gym and get that body that we want. But my data strongly supports the fact that you are who you are anatomically because of your genetics. And there's nothing that you can do to change that. You can't prevent the one bit of acne from erupting on the right side of your nose. And if your twin has the exact same bit of acne at the same place at the same time, then it's not the candy bar you ate. It's not how much you washed your face.
In fact, you have worked with twins where you have detected basal cell cancer on one ear of one identical twin, only to find out that the other twin had that same surgery a year earlier.
At the age of 70. And that's been published. There are these fascinating little circumstances where things that we didn't think were genetically predetermined, like the location of cancer, seem to be pretty consistent. And we need more data on that particular issue of tumor formation. But I also have some good insights into dysplastic nevi, precancerous moles. We're seeing some neat opportunities arise from a research point of view to help inform that whole world.
You have probably photographed more identical twins than anyone else in the world.
We haven't identified anybody who's photographed more. From a scientific point of view, I've photographed 250 pairs, but I've probably worked with an additional 100 pairs non-scientifically. And so that's a lot. That's a lot of imagery. Maybe 20, 30,000 images of identical twins.
A physician asked you once, because he was aware of your fascination, obsession, whatever you want to call it, with twins, and suggested that perhaps you should ask your mother if you were a twin. Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
That sort of caught me a little off guard. There was a foundation that was supporting my work. They still support my work in Chicago. And the director of the foundation, after about 4 years of doing twin research, came up and said, "Why are you so interested?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "I think you should go ask your mother why you're interested in twins." And I thought that was a little ridiculous. I didn't understand it. I thought it was an absurd question. But then, of course, it started eating away at me. And the next time Mom came to town, I cornered her and asked. She said, "Wow, I never thought you'd hear this. I had been told I was carrying twins and then miscarried your other half." And that sounds like, you know, a weird story. But some researchers actually did some background work and proved that if a single birth individual, like myself, aligns with twin pairs, for whatever reason, the best friend of the twins, the twin researcher, the person who obsessively photographs twins, about 80 to 85% of the time, those single birth people will be from pregnancies where there was bleeding at some point in the second or third trimester, which would suggest that there had been a miscarriage of half of the twin pregnancy.
What was it like to find that out for you?
Oh, it was freaky. It was freaky. But I have to say, it was very, it made sense to me. Where is this obsession coming from? Suddenly, it's that I couldn't cuddle with my other half in the uterus anymore. I don't know what it was. But there's this, a little bit of a sense of fascination and curiosity. I don't think loss so much, because there's no negativism that's associated with my situation. But there are single birth people who constantly feel as if something's missing, that they're searching for something, that they are incomplete. Exactly.
If you're just joining us, I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest today is Penn State alum Dr. David Teplica. He's a photographer and a plastic surgeon who lives and works in Chicago. His research into what he calls anatomic predetermination is changing the field of plastic surgery, especially with regard to male patients. And his photographs of identical twins is believed to be the largest collection in the world and has been exhibited worldwide.
Tell us a little bit about photographing twins. How do they feel about being photographed? And some of your photographs are just incredible in terms of their intimacy and how literally entwined you have your subjects in these photographs.
Well, what's interesting is that they're the ones who are often suggesting these poses. I'm not imposing a whole lot on their twin relationship. You may not realize this, but that twin bond is probably the tightest, the closest human bond that can exist. Spousal bonds, sibling bonds, nothing by comparison. You have somebody who has all of your DNA. You have somebody who shared the uterus with you. You have somebody who has the same tastes and thought processes and reaction times and insecurities. I mean, these things are probably all genetically encoded. And you're raised in the same environment, usually, with this same person, and you're each other's best friends. It's almost as if it's your conscious, subconscious kind
alter
of...
Alter ego,
supporting, testing, loving, whatever, right? And unless the household forces individuation, forces them to be different, which I don't believe in, unless they are forced apart from each other, then these two people are often some of the closest things that can happen in the human world. And so to photograph that is just an incredible opportunity, because I basically just say go, and they do these wonderful things that are visually very fascinating.
The really incredible thing about your photographs, they are artistic and beautiful, but they also, to me, serve as tools. I read about the photographers that you admire, and they are photographers like Lewis Hine, the sociologist, who, you know, he used his photography as a tool, as a sociologist, to show what's happening in society, and it seems to me you're doing that exact same thing.
Wow. Yes, it's true. It's an incredibly powerful vehicle for getting ideas and concepts communicated. And I think we as image makers, you're an image maker. We have a moral responsibility to help nudge society in a direction that's more informed, that's kinder, right? And if we can use photography as a tool to extract information about who we are as anatomic people or medical people, wow. So I think there are all kinds of possibilities here.
What have you yet to learn from these twin photographs that you think is just on the horizon?
Every day is another amazing little fun set of discoveries. I have the coolest life. It is so rich. And twins play a very important part of that. But what I'm finding now is that I've been able to use the twin situation to sort of now focus on individuals and how this applies to that. And so the big thrust in my life right now is to try to make sense of where the twin information informs our existence. That's the neatest thing. It turns out it's almost all translatable, which is pretty neat. And so siblings, transmission of genetic information to individual children, either in a straight fashion or in a mirrored anatomic way, those things are all coming down the pike.
And finding these twins is not so difficult. There are literally twin registries all across the globe. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Twin Festival in Twinsburg, Ohio, where you went with 11 other researchers back in 1989 and did some of your very first and earliest work.
Mm-hmm. It's a neat community. They feel a little bit, you know, cast out. And usually they're very interested in participating, because if somebody can help make sense of that, if somebody can help use their perceived difference from the rest of society for the benefit of society, then that makes them feel special. And so there's never been a time when I felt as though twins weren't interested in helping or participating. I'm overloaded with twins who want to get involved. That doesn't mean I wouldn't like a few more to give me a call.
You say they make great models, too, because they're accustomed to being close with one another. And
they don't have the boundaries that the rest of us might have. They feel one with this other person. And so it's a great playground for creative and photographic purposes, and it's a very rich place to be scientifically. Years ago, I did a television discussion on one of the talk shows. I kind of regret doing it now based on all kinds of things, but the studio arranged for me to meet a pair of twins who had been raised apart. And I have to tell you, it was fascinating. They both wore the same plaid shirt, and they both had the same toothpaste from London, because it's the only toothpaste in the world that tastes good. And they both showed up with the same leather toiletry bag.
And they're meeting for the first time.
Fascinating, right? What it says is that we are who we are based upon genetics. And if you want to take some of the credit for that, that's okay. But even that act of needing to take credit is probably genetically encoded. So I think we have a lot to learn about predetermination. And I struggle with that issue because I don't like some of the stuff from the past that was used to judge people. I think that's horrible.
Well, that makes me wonder about something I don't know if you can talk about or not, but what can twins tell us about sexual orientation, for example?
A very brilliant researcher at Northwestern named Michael Bailey has shown that if one twin is gay, then the other twin is much, much more likely to be gay. It's not 100%. But interestingly, his numbers tend to mirror my own numbers with regard to what percentage of twins have mirroring. And I've actually linked this anatomic mirroring to handedness, which means that the dominance of the brain or something about the encoding of the brain is linked to the mirroring of the surface of the skin. And if he's getting 60% in men for concordance of sexuality, and I'm getting 60% in men for mirroring of skin features, that says that there might be predetermined issues in the brain with regard to preferences and laterality and all sorts of things that we need to know more about.
You've been doing this for more than 25 years, studying and photographing twins. Some of this supported by the NIH, for example. What more can we learn from twins?
Well, this is an incredible opportunity. I really believe that you can't just use twin pairs to study things. I think you have to find out, one, that they are indeed monozygotic. They are indeed identical twins. I don't like that word because it implies that they always look exactly the same and that they are the same, when we know that about half of them are mirrors of each other. So monozygotic from one egg. And then I believe that we have to figure out whether or not they are anatomically mirrored, because we think that that can affect brain laterality. And so there are lots of studies that could be done to try to figure out behavior patterns or susceptibility to schizophrenia. I mean, there are all kinds of things that might be informed by figuring out whether the twins are anatomically mirrored or not.
You mentioned schizophrenia, and that reminds me of the fact that one of your images, a wonderful image of two newborns, one suckling the other's nose, is the book cover for Wally Lamb's I Know This Much Is True, which is about identical twins, one of whom suffers from schizophrenia.
Big honor to be included on the cover of that book. It went to number one on the New York Times list. It was Oprah's Book of the Summer or something crazy.
Right.
That image, I think, resonates very well with the public because it shows that there is this established relationship in the twin bond, even at the moment of birth. These are two individuals who are cuddling and holding and caressing each other, even in the uterus. Birgit Erben in, I think, the Netherlands, proved with video ultrasounds in the uterus that the twins are interacting and kissing and punching and touching and doing all sorts of things long before birth. And so there's an established relationship, at least within the last month or so. And that's probably the root for my own obsession or for others who are from ill-fated twin pregnancies, because there is this very tight human bond that happens in the uterus toward the end.
You lecture art and medical students about how we judge people by their looks. And you say that as a society, we are cruel, very, very cruel to people who have facial disfigurement. As a plastic surgeon, how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I want to say that it is not unique to the human species. Other species will toss the baby into the river if the baby looks wrong. Humans in the Middle Ages wouldn't let their children go play beneath the bridge because the boogeyman will get you, but they would throw things over and things would wash up on the shores. And so we're a very cruel species, as other species are very cruel with disfigurement and disability. It's just part of being an animal. We don't like to think of ourselves as animals, but...
Your practice is divided between reconstruction and cosmetic surgery, and throughout your career you have worked with cancer patients and those who have HIV and have something called cheek wasting, with burn victims, with accident victims, and then just the person who wants to have a slimmer thighs. is some of your work more satisfying than others?
Oh, boy, what a loaded question. I'm fascinated by that whole interface. Every insurance company in the United States will pay for the CEO, poor guy, to have the skin cancers taken off of his face. He knows that in his family, everybody gets skin cancers. It's genetically encoded, I suppose, in some way. But he still goes out in the sun, promotes that, doesn't wear sunscreen, and we will pay for him to have his skin cancers taken care of. But then another individual, perhaps a lawyer, who's in the family, the face wastes and shrivels, and the skin hangs, a genetic condition also, and not one insurance company will pay to rehabilitate the face of that individual so that he can be a productive member of society and win the cases in the courtroom, because even the jury doesn't want to look at his saggy face, and they will err against his client because he doesn't look good.
And you think that should be covered?
I don't know what should be covered. I'm not going to make society's decisions. But I like to point out that there are so many inconsistencies. And I don't, because I believe in the primacy of genetics for body issues, I don't know how we can say this thing is worthy and this thing is not worthy. Somebody doesn't wear a seatbelt in the car and gets a facial disfigurement, I think they should pay to have their face taken care of.
And you say most of us are after, we want to look normal or average, not necessarily beautiful.
You've done your background homework. Oh, my goodness. I'm fascinated that almost 100% of the patients who walk through the door want to go toward the mean. My colleagues and me formerly would say we're making people beautiful. But almost never do we know what that beauty norm is, and instead what is requested of the patient, from the patient, is to get rid of the hump on the nose that the average person doesn't have, or to make the jaw bigger, which the average person
does
have.
So
they fit in, so they look normal and average. So there is an argument that societal beauty might be closest to the mean for all body parts.
So I want to ask you one final question, and it may be too personal, so wave me off if it is. I've always wanted to ask a plastic surgeon if they themselves have had plastic surgery.
I can show you the things I need to have done, but at the moment, because I am a guy and because very few plastic surgeons focus on men, I have not yet done anything. I have to train somebody to figure out how to masculinize a middle-aged guy who's showing his little feminine anatomic developments.
You see more male patients probably than any other plastic surgeon. Do you think that's going to change? I went to your talk today at the Penn State Forum, and I thought, don't other plastic surgeons know what you were talking about? It sounded just so sensical and
none of what you saw in the presentation today is the party line for the world of plastic surgery. So I have a very high percentage. I would say that 70 to 75% of my practice is men. It's CEOs, executives, entrepreneurs, entertainers, politicians. It's guys who cannot afford to be feminized. Guys from all over the country who really don't want to change much about who they are. They're trying to recapture their masculine youth. But the procedures that we do routinely as plastic surgeons feminize. And so this is a very dangerous place to be. So I will have my own plastic surgical work as soon as possible, I promise.
When you find the right person or you train the right person. David Teplica, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Wonderful.
That was Dr. David Teplica. He has one of the largest male clientele plastic surgery practices in the country, and that practice has been influenced by his art background and his 25-year study of identical twins. For more information, check the links at our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.